This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. In the medical community, you hear regular conversations about preventative care versus treatment. Do we invest more time, energy, and research into solutions that fix a problem or those that seek to stop it from happening in the first place? The circumstances vary and they dictate the results. But as we've seen over the past year during the pandemic, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Well, there's a parallel in our battle with the climate crisis, because the main cause of climate disruption is the heat-trapping carbon dioxide that we pump into the air. And we've spent most of our efforts trying to reduce the amount of CO2 that we generate. We can do that by changing the way we generate electricity or power our cars and buses. We can also generate less CO2 just by being more energy efficient. If your house is well insulated, your gas furnace doesn't have to work so hard or pollute as much. And the same goes for steel mills and oil refineries, just to name industrial facilities that use a lot of energy. Think of all of this as pollution prevention, what I call a front-end strategy for cutting carbon dioxide. Now, the players on that team are often people in the renewable energy space: solar power, wind, water, geothermal heat, or they're folks that are working in the efficiency space, companies that make double-pane windows or fuel-efficient boilers at the petroleum plant. Recently, though, scientists and engineers have been experimenting with what I will call a back-end strategy. The idea is that, realistically speaking, there will be some processes that we cannot rapidly decarbonize. So we need to think about capturing that carbon and storing it in some kind of permanent way, say by injecting it into the ground. Now, that's not pollution prevention. It's waste treatment, a kind of carbon landfill. It's called CCS, which stands for carbon capture and storage. Sometimes people say sequestration instead of storage, but they both start with S, so you can't go wrong with CCS. Anyway, the industries on the side of CCS are most prominently fossil fuel companies, which makes sense because for them, pollution prevention is a money-losing strategy. Their product makes pollution. But with waste treatment, industry can continue operating as they always have, generating energy from fossil fuels. So they propose that in addition, they will install a system within their production lines that strip carbon from the other pollutants before it leaves the smokestack. The carbon will be funneled through pipelines and injected deep into the ground, where it will be buried forever. As a result, the plants can keep running, business rallies, and there's less pollution in the air. Everybody wins. Well, not quite. As we'll see today, carbon capture and storage, or CCS, is not nearly robust enough to treat carbon waste on a scale that's necessary to make a meaningful difference. On top of that, there are some serious risks that are involved. And the whole process might even end up burning more energy than it saves. That ounce of prevention turns out to be a whole lot cleaner and cheaper, too.
Maybe the presumption should be find some other way, like actually reduce your carbon emissions rather than burning carbon and capturing it as a last-ditch effort.
When we think about what it means to answer this climate calamity that we're in worldwide, if we're going to make these kind of investments, we ought to have a bit more certainty about what those outcomes are going to look like, even in the best case scenario.
We need to make a transition away from putting carbon into the atmosphere and into greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And how can we do that in ways that allow us to achieve multiple benefits, including reducing pollution in frontline communities who have suffered disproportionately from our reliance on fossil fuels.
There's also other complications like faulting. They've been injecting a lot of fluid down in Oklahoma as part of fracking operations, and that's led to an increase in seismicity and in earthquakes. And so one possible concern is if you add in these high-pressure fluids, would you activate faults?
It's a time bomb, a powder keg. And given all the climate harms we know are baked in and that we essentially have been going down the bridge to nowhere for so long that the industry has put us on, we don't have time. And we will be at a point where future generations, if something happens and that is released, then parts of the planet will become uninhabitable.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, we take on energy justice. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. On today's episode, we're exploring a controversial strategy for reducing carbon dioxide emissions, carbon capture and storage, also sometimes called carbon capture and sequestration. Either way, the short name is CCS. Is it merely a compromise for large corporations to continue business as usual? Or does CCS offer benefits that we should be more thoughtfully considering? For decades now, the fossil fuel industry has been tasked with finding ways to decrease the greenhouse gases that they put into the air, carbon dioxide being the most important one. And there have been various measures established to hold them accountable. Yet here we are in 2021, and the burning of fossil fuels still accounts for about 80% of emissions that cause climate disruption. So the stakes are high, and in response, these companies have presented carbon capture and storage as a promising new way of reducing carbon pollution. CCS offers fossil fuel companies the ability to continue standard operations with one addition to the program. The system remains in place, it just has a better filter. Before we get too far in today's discussion, however, I want to define some terms. We're going to be talking a lot about renewable energy and non-renewable energy. Now, renewable energy, which is carbon-free energy, comes from natural sources or processes that are constantly replenished. So, for example, sunlight or wind keep shining and blowing, even if their availability depends on time and weather. More than 1/8 of all energy generated in the United States right now is from renewables. Now, renewables include solar, wind, hydroelectric power, biomass, which is the burning of organic material, geothermal power, and tidal energy from the ocean. Non-renewable energy includes fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal, all of which produce carbon dioxide. Non-renewable sources of energy are only available in limited amounts and take a long time to replenish. So when we pump gas at the station, we're using a finite resource refined from crude oil that's been around since prehistoric times. What about nuclear energy? Well, nuclear energy is usually considered a non-renewable energy source. Although nuclear energy itself is a renewable energy source, the uranium that is used in nuclear power plants is not. But nuclear energy is carbon-free, and so many people see it as an important way to help decarbonize the energy economy. Now, there is an enormous amount of infrastructure and investment in the non-renewable fossil fuel industry. And people by nature don't tend to take big chances. CCS can be appealing because it feels like less work than completely abandoning ship for renewables. It allows those working in fossil fuel production to continue doing what they can do while also attempting to help with climate change initiatives. To encourage the development of CCS, the Trump administration reopened discussions to subsidize the technology. And in 2018, Congress approved a tax break for companies that trap carbon dioxide produced by industrial sites before the gas escapes into the atmosphere. This development was delayed by the IRS a little bit, which struggled to outline how regulations would work, but it's been moving forward more recently. The thing is, there's a lot more to pollution than just carbon dioxide, and the best way to reduce it is to stop using fossil fuels completely. That, of course, would signal the end of some of these fossil fuel corporations. According to Forbes, while energy consumption was previously dominated by petroleum and coal, by 2019, petroleum was still number one, natural gas was second, renewables were third, and coal was number four. So the interest in clean energy has risen. On the flip side, oil and gas stocks have been trending lower since 2014. In January, the CEOs of Exxon and Chevron actually discussed a merger. I think we should look now at how CCS even works to get a better sense of the process. I spoke with Alex Kolker, an associate professor for the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. He's a Fulbright scholar and a researcher, and he explained the general concept.
When we extract oil, you find a geological formation where you think that there is oil in the ground, and you stick a well down and you pull up the oil, and then you convert that oil into the various compound that you want to utilize. The CCS, and of course sometimes it's called carbon capture utilization or geological sequestration, is in some ways the reverse of that. It is taking CO2 either directly from the air or CO2 that's coming out of an industrial process that would have gone into the air, and piping that underground into an area where one thinks that it would stay for a geologically long period of time. It could be refining, it could be combustion. Basically, you could get the CO2 at the source. So effectively, you're pulling it out at or near the pipe that it's coming out of.
The CCS process is relatively new, and it's only minimally been tested. You may already be thinking of a few problems that could result. Specifically, where exactly do we bury the CO2? And when it's pumped in, can you just forget about it, screw the cap on, and walk away? That's the first big hurdle.
Where you put it underground is a big question. In the sort of big picture, one would need to find a place underground where the rocks are able to absorb the CO2 and that you would put down, and you'd probably push it down as some kind of supercritical liquid, which is basically a high pressure liquid. And you would pump it underground and you'd find a place where the geology would be conducive to this carbon dioxide staying underground for a very long period of time. And so what that means is you need to have some kind of rock that's porous enough that it could absorb the CO2, but you also want above that some kind of confining layer that would prevent the carbon dioxide from coming back up to the surface. In some ways, it's not unlike the kind of geological questions people ask when they're looking for oil. When they're looking for oil, they want to know the sedimentary properties of the rock and how much carbon there is there and how easy it is for oil to flow and where various carbon compounds might stay. In carbon geological sequestration, you want to ask some of these similar questions, but you want to do it with a lens to what keeps carbon dioxide down. You want to make sure that there's no leakage of carbon dioxide into other structures. The rocks beneath the surface of the earth, you think that they're, you know, all completely dense, but in fact they're not. In some places, gases and liquids can flow. Sometimes they can flow horizontally, and some places they can flow vertically. One would want to find a location where the carbon dioxide is going to stay and where it's not going to move to. And you want to make sure that it's there for almost infinity, right? So one major concern is that carbon dioxide might leak back up to the atmosphere. Eventually, carbon dioxide could, you know, convert back in from this supercritical liquid to back up into a gaseous form, and you don't want it bubbling up to the surface.
Potential leaks aside, many people do see advantages to using CCS. One could argue that it's better than doing nothing, right? Although, as we'll see later, some feel otherwise. If the goal is to keep carbon out of the air, well, that's what CCS does, and companies are beginning to adopt the practice. The Global CCS Status Report shows that global capture and storage capacity has increased by 33% since 2019, and there are 65 commercial CCS facilities in various stages of development globally. Along with a newfound corporate drive to be sustainable, coupled with government regulations, maybe CCS could be some kind of a viable option. From Alex Kolker's perspective, one benefit of CCS is that the process remains fairly isolated from human interference.
Net zero means it has the implication that there may be some CO2 emissions that would be offset with something else, and this CCS is one of those potential offsets. Though I could say there's other offsets. There could be forests, could be offsets, or building wetlands that have CO2 could be offsets. One potential advantage of this as an offset is that it's deep underground. And so if you can find a place that's geologically secure, it could stay there for a long time. And it's less likely to be directly impacted by people. So forests, you run the threat of wildfires or beetles, and marshes, you run the threat that they erode. And so putting something deep underground is away from people and some of the activities that we have on the surface of this planet.
In addition, some areas of the country seem well suited for this.
There are some larger projects that are going on in terms of injecting CO2 underground. For example, people inject CO2 underground to enhance oil recovery. But the object of that is not to put CO2 underground. It's to use this fluid in order to extract more oil. Likewise, we throw plenty of other things underground. The geology is somewhat favorable. There's the potential for things like jobs. You're creating some large industrial facilities. Those places would presumably employ people both in the construction phase and also in the operations phase. So there are some potential benefits on that side.
You may remember Hannah Wiseman from our previous episode. She's a CPR member scholar and a professor at the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences and the Institutes of Energy and Environment at Penn State University. She sees CCS as more of a compromise for corporations.
Other technological options should be considered before jumping immediately to the carbon capture and sequestration option. The more we just jump to the conclusion that, well, it's hard to get to low carbon in this sector, so let's just keep burning a fossil fuel and capture the carbon. The more we do that, the more risk there is of sort of stagnant technological approaches rather than innovation, right? And it continues our need to drill for and hydraulically fracture for these fossil fuels, right? I mean, the more we're continuing down that path, I think the more tempting it will be in all industries, even those that are not difficult to electrify or otherwise reduce emissions, to say, oh, let's just go with CCS, right? So I think we need a cabinet. I think we need to say, well, if we really can't find other technological solutions to producing this massive amount of heat, maybe it should even be an exemption, right? I mean, maybe the presumption should be find some other way, like actually reduce your carbon emissions rather than burning carbon and capturing it as a last-ditch effort.
The demand for climate solutions and new technology being so strong right now, as Hannah points out, CCS could distract from more efficient and effective approaches to climate mitigation.
Let's look at a university, for example, like Penn State. You've got a bunch of engineers here who are experts in everything from mining to oil and gas to development of geothermal wells. And they can focus their research efforts in different areas, and it's somewhat malleable. I mean, I know researchers who are now transferring their oil and gas engineering skills over to geothermal. There are really interesting transferable skills, but I worry that less of that transfer will occur and less focus on better innovative technologies will occur if we put too many eggs in the CCS basket.
So, carbon capture and storage may have some advantages. There are engineers and scientists who believe it's even the most cost-effective approach. But from an environmental perspective, there are more cons than pros. To start with, if our end goal is to stop using fossil fuels, Why would we want to invest more money, time, and infrastructure into developing a solution that doesn't work towards that aim? Not to mention the fact that CCS is energy intensive and destroying resources in order to build the necessary pipelines to transport carbon dioxide into the ground. Again, here's Alex Kolker, who's been studying how CCS could affect areas in Louisiana and around the Gulf Coast. This is a region that industry has been quite excited about in terms of CCS because the geological features look promising. And on account of all the oil refineries and chemical plants, there's a lot of CO2 that needs storing.
I think the analogy to oil drilling is not a bad one, and it leads to some of the same concerns that one has. So, for example, how does the CO2 get to the sites where it's injected? It would probably require a pipeline. That pipeline, because it's the Gulf, may need to go through wetlands. The pipeline would be vulnerable to storm surge and hurricanes like any of the other pipelines. There's a lot of pipelines, and of course, in the mid part of the 20th century, those pipelines were sited without a lot of forethought, and that is one of the many contributing factors to the land loss crisis that we've had here in Louisiana. So pipelines, you know, in the surface, I mean, you're putting a pipeline on the marsh, you're often doing something erosive in order to put the pipeline in, you're digging a canal, and then once the pipeline's there, you've got a hydrological impediment to flow. It's bordered by rocks or dredge fill in order to keep boaters out. Of course, by doing that, you rearrange the hydrology in the Gulf or in the marsh where you're at, and that can often be detrimental to the marsh, can often lead to marsh loss.
Beyond damage done to the environment from such development, CCS could cause additional burdens to communities in this area without fulfilling its purpose. Alice Kaswan is a professor and associate dean at the University of San Francisco who specializes in climate change and environmental justice. She's a member scholar at CPR, too. Alice says we should be skeptical.
So there are a couple of things that are a concern about carbon capture and storage. One is that it's very energy intensive itself. It's not as though it is itself costless. You'll have to consume even more energy than you did before because you're going to have to power the carbon capture and storage technology. So that means all the extractive and other concerns we have, whether it's the fracking of natural gas or the extraction of coal or the oil, whatever it is you're relying on for your energy source, you're going to have to rely on more of it in order to be able to power the carbon capture and storage. The other concern goes to a larger issue, and that is about thinking about climate strategies that allow us to achieve multiple benefits, not just greenhouse gas reduction benefits, including reducing pollution in frontline communities who have suffered disproportionately from our reliance on fossil fuels, which, as we know, emit not only, obviously, greenhouse gases, carbon in particular, but also a lot of toxics that have long been disproportionately impacting frontline communities of color and low-income communities. The other concern about carbon capture and storage is that it strips only the carbon. What you end up with then is little, if any, reduction in the stream of the conventional or co-pollutants that go along with carbon. And because you're having to use more energy to do the technology of carbon capture, you end up potentially with even more co-pollutants because you're actually having to burn more gas or burn more coal or whatever you're using in order to power the carbon capture.
As Alex suggests, it's easy to focus on carbon dioxide as the sole environmental challenge today, but much of the country also suffers from other air pollutants like smog, soot, and mercury. They don't directly cause climate change, but every year they cause thousands of premature deaths. And they also contribute to serious respiratory illnesses in children and with the elderly. Because CCS doesn't strip those pollutants out of the waste stream, exposed communities will continue to get hammered with those things. Whereas if the fossil fuel had been replaced with renewables, they wouldn't have those sorts of pollutions in their neighborhoods anymore. Karen Sokol, a CPR member scholar and a professor of law at Loyola University New Orleans, compares the CCS approach to how tobacco companies responded to nicotine regulations back in the day.
There was a point at which the public was aware that cigarettes, the nicotine in them was highly addictive, and that the tobacco caused catastrophic diseases. And there was a push to rein in the epidemic. It was recognized as a crisis. Part of the tobacco industry strategy in response was what I call a strategy of disinformation plus path dependence. Part of the disinformation was creating a product that said it was a fix. That is, you can have all the benefits of nicotine delivery without the bad stuff, without the stuff that's going to cause respiratory diseases, because it all gets filtered out. So you get the good stuff, bad stuff's filtered out. Turns out that wasn't the case. It turns out that actually it didn't filter out any of the toxins in the tobacco product. Further, it turns out that it was actually worse for public health, because it turns out that the filters actually increased nicotine delivery. That's simply because you tend to take harder drags on the cigarette as a result and got more nicotine delivery. The more nicotine delivery you have, each intake, so to speak, the quicker you get addicted. That's where the path dependence comes in. But then you're hooked. And as far as the industry is concerned, that's how it keeps its consumer base and thus its profits up. Similarly, the oil and gas industry, the fossil fuel industry, in many ways wrote the playbook for that strategy. In fact, it was implementing the strategy with respect to climate policy, we now know, before the tobacco industry. It has done things like the switch to natural gas. Even the term natural gas is part of a disinformation campaign, the idea that natural is cleaner, that something about it is safer. That disinformation was coupled with a massive funding of research that led us down a path where natural gas seemed like the big solution to controlling what we at that point knew was a climate crisis. What that also coupled with, the path dependence part, was a massive build out of infrastructure. Once you build out all the pipeline networks, all the processing stations, everything that goes into it, it's very, very difficult to reverse. You have it around for a long time.
And because this topic can be difficult to understand, disinformation easily leads the public astray, particularly when many of us are still unused to using solar power and wind power as our primary source of electricity. We feel more comfortable with what's already established.
They're talking about things like clean coal. They're talking about the ability essentially to continue fossil fuel production, oil, gas, coal, and not have it cause the climate crisis. So CCS is a way of saying, hey, we care about this climate crisis. We're dealing with it. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to continue what we've always done. We're the engine on which society runs. We just don't have to worry about those emissions that we have to control, because we will capture them and put them all underground. There's some catches, and those catches are, one, we don't have any proof that it's going to stay underground. At best, we're signing up future generations to manage a colossal amount of toxic waste forever, and we're completely uncertain that it will stay underground. Two, they don't say anything about the local pollution, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, that is having catastrophic effects, particularly on fence-line communities, largely low-income communities of color who have been on the front lines of the climate crisis from the beginning. Particulate matter is, in particular, a recent study has come out that indicated it was twice as deadly as we believed before. And we realized how deadly it was before, particularly in those communities near the infrastructure. It also looks like it would increase nitrous oxide and sulfur dioxide. The problem with that also is that it actually takes a lot of energy to take the carbon emissions and put them underground. So actually, it would increase those local pollutants, and it will be a process, a vast process. It's going to require a massive build out of infrastructure that's going to inflict its own harms on these same communities.
We've heard a few people now mention one alarming problem that could result from installation of CCS systems: leaks. What happens when the carbon dioxide comes back up? Or worse, what if it blows up? We've seen this happen with other gases stashed underground. In 2019, the Los Angeles Times reports that 100,000 cubic feet of natural gas escaped into the atmosphere in an area of Los Angeles that served as an oil hub. 4 years later, in a nearby community, methane leaked from another storage field, poisoning residents and forcing thousands of people to evacuate. What if we put all that money into capturing and storing CO2 only to have it cause further pollution and erupt in our face? It's a concern of Hannah Wiseman's.
I think there are a lot of questions about the efficacy of sequestering it for thousands of years. I mean, it can probably be done. We are, after all, in the United States, experts at doing stuff underground, like drilling for oil and gas. We've, of course, been using carbon to get more oil and gas out of the ground. Oil and gas companies have been injecting it for that purpose. But even there, I mean, look at the natural gas storage issue at Aliso Canyon in California a few years ago, right? I mean, there was a massive methane leak from a rock formation that was supposed to be storing the natural gas until we need it. And it caused California to exceed its emissions for at least a year. I mean, it was just incredible how much methane came out of that storage.
Alex Kolker again likens it to the hazards of drilling for oil, which involve man-made, artificially implanted infrastructure that must coalesce almost flawlessly with the natural environment.
Presumably, there's going to be a large industrial activity in order to either pull CO2 out of the atmosphere or compress it into a supercritical fluid. That's probably going to be a loud, energy-intensive operation. From time to time, there have been CO2 leaks. So CO2 in moderate levels is, of course, non-toxic. We breathe it out in every breath. But in high levels, it can smother you. I think there was up in Delhi, Louisiana, a few years ago, there was a CO2 leak and there were livestock that were killed as a result. You certainly would be concerned about any leak and the potential for that kind of outbreak. If you're putting pipelines in marshes, you've got potential impacts to people that make their living off of the marsh and require the marsh habitat to be functional in order to harvest shrimp or alligators or whatever else they harvest. There's also other complications like faulting. They've been injecting a lot of fluid down in Oklahoma as part of fracking operations, and that's led to an increase in seismicity and in earthquakes. One possible concern is if you add in these high-pressure fluids, would you activate faults?
That's right. The use of carbon capture and storage could actually cause earth tremors. According to researchers at Stanford University, to significantly reduce emissions, CCS would need to sequester upwards of 3.5 billion metric tons of CO2, which in many areas may create a pressure buildup large enough to break the reservoir's seal. Their study found that even a fault slip of a few centimeters could allow stored CO2 to reach the surface, which is a problem because these repositories need a leak rate of less than 1% every 1,000 years to be effective. If such slippage occurs, it could not only pollute the air with carbon dioxide, but it could kill animals and vegetation and do serious harm to those who live in the area. This is one more reason why Karen Sokol is skeptical.
The Global Carbon Capture and Sequestration Institute, its studies indicate that we would need a 21,000-mile expansion of CO2 pipelines in North America, at the very least. So that means they're going to cross through communities, and we've seen all the impacts of that. Concomitant, all the risks we have of fossil fuel industry infrastructure, explosions, spills. It's constant work in trying to control it. The infrastructure will continue to age, and it will likely be even more susceptible to explosions, leaks, ruptures, all these other dangers, because as we've seen, climate disruption is destroying our infrastructure because all of these things are happening that we're unprepared for. Similarly, right now, there's no way of monitoring CO2 underneath the ground to determine if there are potential leaks, to determine if leaks are coming up. There's no technology for that yet developed because it hasn't been in practice. But we're essentially doing the same thing we've been doing forever, rather than shifting to something that has all these benefits. It's a time bomb, a powder keg. Given all the climate harms we know are baked in, and that we essentially have been going down the bridge to nowhere for so long that the industry has put us on, we don't have time. And we will be at a point where future generations, if something happens and that is released, parts of the planet will become uninhabitable.
I have a hunch that the industries that helped get us into the climate change mess are probably not the ones who are going to get us out. For decades, the fossil fuel industry has told us that climate disruption was not happening at all. Then they told us that it was, but that it was too expensive to address. Now they tell us that the crisis can be addressed, but that we don't have to reduce fossil fuel consumption in order to fix the problem. Look, I'm not saying that we shouldn't continue researching CCS technology. I'm not even saying that the technology shouldn't be part of a larger climate action strategy. But like Hannah Wiseman, I don't understand why we should see this as anything but a last resort strategy when we've tried the other things. Renewable energy, for instance, is cheaper. It doesn't require thousands of years of monitoring. And renewables eliminate other pollutants like smog and soot, thus helping communities that have historically borne disproportionate environmental burdens. Last episode, I introduced you to Flozell Daniels Jr. He's the CEO and president of the Foundation for Louisiana and a former public policy specialist for the city of New Orleans. CCS is something that he's been researching and paying a lot of attention to.
When we look at something like carbon capture and storage and communities' concern, it makes a lot of sense that people are thinking, wow, this is not going to be good for us, potentially. It looks very similar to prior instances of massive capital investments made in industries that no one understood and no one truthfully shared what potential outcomes it would have on those communities from an environmental perspective. But it's not just environmental. All of these things intersect. You know, for instance, what's going to happen economically with those communities when people are trying to do community development and economic development? One of the things that you look for is what industries exist that would turn away other opportunities to develop creative and diverse economies, potentially clean industries, creative industries, technology-driven industries may look at this kind of industrial expansion and think, well, you know, my employees and their children are not going to want to move to Louisiana to this place. People are really smart and have a savvy, almost a sophisticated approach to assessing whether or not these things are good opportunities for them.
E&E News points out that the Biden administration outlined building next generation industries in distressed communities as a way of boosting economic factors. What's being called a pioneer facility would test carbon capture systems on steel, cement, and chemical production plants as part of a $15 billion fund for research and development. This news was not well received by everyone, however, with various climate justice activists calling it misguided and an attempt at, quote, subsidizing dirty energy development and propping up the fossil fuel industry. One senator said that investing in carbon capture is, quote, completely pointless, considering the other renewable options.
It's such a technical and huge issue. Most people are struggling to wrap their brains around it. While there's a lot of interest and what seems to me certainly a lot of emerging buy-in from industry and some elected officials, I think there's some serious cause for concern after you distinguish between natural forms of carbon capture and storage and sort of these ideas about industrializing CCS as an activity. It's not proven. It's only been very sparely used and not verified from an efficacy perspective. So when we think about emissions, when we think about what it means to answer this climate calamity that we're in worldwide, if we're going to make these kind of investments, we ought to have a bit more certainty about what those outcomes are going to look like. Even in the best case scenario, it has a minority impact on reducing emissions and therefore having the more global impact that we're looking for. Also, understand it's hyper expensive. You know, I think this is like any other big policy issue, whether it's healthcare or housing or disaster resilience, we're going to have to spend a lot of money to be effective on answering the climate change challenge and climate justice issues. But we're going to have to make some choices. And I have a real question about whether spending the billions and billions that I understand it will take to implement a carbon capture and storage approach is the highest and best use of our resources. There really are better options. And last, it's potential harm to communities. My appreciation is that we don't understand enough to know about what the potential ramifications are of an at-scale implementation of carbon capture and storage. If history is an indicator, those things being done in a very racially inequitable way, which would be our expectation.
Karen Sokol agrees. For her, it's renewable energy or bust.
We're at a fork in the road. And if you consider all these risks, the switch is a no-brainer. But the industry is using the inertia of right now being on a fossil fuel path to continue there. So for the same energy cost, because it would cost more energy to build out CCS, wind turbines and solar panels reduce a lot more CO2 while they reduce all those problems that we've long been plagued by as a result of a societal dependence on fossil fuel extraction and production. They decrease the particulate matter. They decrease all those pollutants. They decrease dependence on pipelines, refineries, gas stations, tanker trucks, oil tankers, coal trains, oil spills, oil fires, gas leaks, gas explosion, and international conflicts over energy.
I started out today talking about public health as a way to talk about climate change. That got me thinking of my own health, because you know, as summer starts, I'm wanting to lose a little bit of weight, right? And as anyone can tell you who's ever tried to drop 10 or 15 pounds, really the only way to do it, for sure, is to stop eating so many calories. Now, on top of that, you can get a fancy gym membership, or you can go out and buy one of those really cool electronic stationary bikes, and that can be totally fun. But I have talked to some of my colleagues who've gone out and gotten those fancy electronic stationary bikes, and I've learned two things. One is people who have fancy electronic stationary bikes love to talk about their fancy electronic stationary bikes. But the second thing is that nobody who's got one has actually lost weight without also reducing the calories. And the reason's pretty simple. Preventing excess calories from coming into your body on the front end is much more efficient than trying to burn those excess calories off on the back end. Because what we've seen with weight loss, health epidemics, cancer, other medical ailments, what we find is time and again, an ounce of prevention is worth even a few metric tons of cure. I'll leave you with a final word from Alice Kazwan.
A lot of what I think needs to guide our climate policy is a broader vision that integrates concerns about the environment more broadly and about the economy more broadly. And we need to be thinking about climate strategies that are not only addressing sort of the single issue of how do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but how do we envision a broader clean energy future? And what should that look like? Thinking broadly about other contaminants, about trying to improve the lives of people who work in the energy context, about the communities who are affected by our infrastructure. And I do think that takes a lot of thinking. I mean, it's hard to imagine something that's quite different from what we have, even if we don't always like what we have, right? It's hard to envision.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For information on this episode, please visit our website, progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CPRblog or on Instagram at progressivereform, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. Tell us how you like it. That will help us reach out to more listeners who want to connect the dots on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guests today, Alex Kolker, Hannah Wiseman, Alice Kazwan, Karen Sokol, and Flozell Daniels, as well as our assistant producer, Brian Gum, and our producer, Courtney Garcia. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions, and I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.